history pages. Bring all my wits and sages back down from the glacial ages. Dance around my atom fire. Bring all my blood relations. Bring all my worried nations back down through my civilizations. Dance around my atom fire. 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 I'll bring my sons and daughters. I'll bring my heavy waters. Titanium, uranium. Dance around my atom fire. Bring all my lads and lasses. Nitro and blister gases. Brotherhood or a world of ashes. Dance around my atom fire. 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 Dance around my atom fire.
A Woody Guthrie classic there that not that many people know about. Dance Around My Atom Fire is performed by Joel Raphael here on Green Zine here at WFVR-LP South Royalton. Henry Swayze is with me. I'm going to bring him up in the mix, but let's take care of a little bit of business, and that is to acknowledge the folks that have kept this show on the air for nearly 13 years, as well as this radio station on the air. We are celebrating our 13th anniversary in March. It'll be at the tail end of our once-a-year on-air fun drive, which is happening from Saturday, March 7th through Friday, lucky day, Friday, March the 13th. You'll be hearing more about it as we get closer to that date. Green Zine is brought to you today by the kind folks at Soleflect, also Bale. We're going to get back to them in just a moment. Building a local economy. Find out more about their activities at balevt.org. Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Wit and Grit, and the Yes We Can Collective. In fact, I need to go take some things in for the collective as they are mounting up here. And let's see. Yeah, I'm going to bring up Henry, and then we're going to, before we go to Bird Note, I want to go back to nuclear power in just a moment. Hey, good morning, Henry.
Good morning there. How is the world in South Royalton, Vermont?
Well, from my perch high atop Magic Mountain, I haven't seen any, well, actually, I have seen some crows. I haven't seen a raven yet, but we're going to talk about them in a little bit. It's a beautiful sunny day. There's still powder in the woods. I think people are mostly smiling because they haven't been listening to the latest headlines out of D.C. And, no, it's been a pretty good day here at the radio station. How about up there in the Queen City?
Yeah, it's a good place to have your head out of the news media and and enjoy. I was out on the down on the Intervale looking for good places to get a walk in. And it was yesterday, and lots of people cross-country skiing there, and that made me think, you know, maybe I ought to try breaking out my cross-country skis.
Definitely.
All level territory there, so it's a meandering ski if you want it to be, or you can race as you like, but a lot of trails, and so I walked down the plowed part of the roadway as far as it would go and back. That was a couple of miles of walking, no grade, so not really a great walk. But I heard a raven, and the raven was very close and very loud, and I realized that it went from being in front of me to being in behind me. And I turned around, tried to crane my neck and see where this raven was. And it was on the way up in a tall tree right above the roadway. I could have reached out and touched the tree as I went by.
Wow.
And it was an insistent croak, croak, croak.
That's pretty good.
Croak, and just went on and on and on. And on my way back, I heard it change its tune, and I think its mate was answering it. So I thought we should dig into Ravens with that experience in hand.
Yeah, we should. And, you know, we'll hold off maybe in the last 10 minutes or if we have time after the Raven, a couple of pieces. One about an event that's happening at the Vermont Law and Graduate School that dealing with nuclear power, and that's coming up on Tuesday night at 5:30 in Oaks 210. And also we want to update as far as our energy supply here in the state of Vermont, the latest comments coming from Governor Phil Scott. But let's go to Bird Note right now, and maybe we'll be hearing that sound that you just made, Henry. And this piece from Bird Note is called Ravens and Crows, Who's Who.
This is Bird Note. So you're walking down the street, and a trash can's been tipped over. And eagerly picking through the riches strewn across the sidewalk are several black birds. They're crows. Or ravens. No, definitely crows. Maybe? How can you tell the difference? Well, first off, listen. Crows caw, while ravens croak. And while common ravens and American crows look quite similar, there are a few ways to tell them apart. Ravens are larger, and they often travel in pairs. Crows usually hang out in larger groups. Next, try to get a look at the bird's tail. A crow's tail feathers are basically all the same length, so its tail opens like a fan. But a raven has longer middle feathers in its tail, so it looks more like a wedge or a triangle. By far, though, the best way to tell these two birds apart is to look at their bills. The crow has a modest bill, but the raven has a great big chunky-looking beak that pretty much says, "Yeah, that's right, I'm a raven." Ravens tend to stick to the wilder parts of the world, like woodlands and open spaces. But when you're walking past those trash cans, you're probably seeing crows. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Here we go. Sorry, I've got four sliders going at the same time, but I've got you turned up there, Henry.
If I'd only known, I could have been talking. All right. Yes. So just if we want to go on a moment longer on crows and ravens.
Yeah, let's go. Let's go a moment longer, then we'll move over to nuclear power, and then we'll probably be up to time to be welcoming our guest.
All right. So Peter Sterling will be our guest when we get to guest time, and we'll talk about electricity costs in the state of Vermont and across the country and why New England is by far and away the most expensive zone in the country for electricity.
Mm-hmm.
There are places in the country where electricity's less than half the price of what Vermonters pay.
Wow.
And they're places that I don't think of as having very good power sources. So it's weird. Anyway, we'll get into that. And going back to ravens and crows, they both mate for long periods of times, ravens for life. And the ravens live longer than crows. In the wild, they both can tend to go out to about 15 years. But in captivity, a raven can go all the way to 80 years.
Wow.
So if they have a kindly diet. And anyway, so maybe that's enough for the moment. But they're both smart, and they're both ravens are in pairs. They pretty much hang out with a pair and maybe with last year's offspring with them. But crows have a larger community. So anyway, those are little background.
Yeah, and then we'll just go briefly to Edgar Allan Poe. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Maybe we'll include that on the next word stream. All right, we're going to shift over to nuclear power, something that's been around for quite a while and is back in the news again. I am reading, in fact, we support independent media. We count ourselves as an independent media outlet. We do bring you Democracy Now! We bring you shows here like Green Zine and Wordstream, etc. And we want to give a tip of the hat to Vermont Digger. This article written by Austin Gaffney in vtdigger.org. That's where you can find this. And it was written on January 20th. Governor Scott forecasts comeback for nuclear. He has been a long time. This isn't news as far as his support for nuclear energy. He's a longtime proponent of it. And he threw his weight behind a new bill a couple weeks ago that could usher in a comeback for nuclear later on this year. Quoting the governor, "There's a better way to lower energy prices and reduce emissions much faster if you're willing to work with us to change course," he told the lawmakers in his budget address. He voiced support for a bill, which is House Bill 601, a bill introduced by House Minority Leader Representative Patty McCoy, a Republican from Pulteney. And that bill would alter an existing state law, the Renewable Energy Standard. Now, this is where the language starts to get a little mushy. That the current Renewable Energy Standard requires all Vermont utilities to reach 100% renewable energy like solar and wind by the year 2035. So that's, 9 years from now? Under the bill, 2035, under the bill, the law would be renamed the Clean Energy Standard. So away from renewable and now clean energy standard. And it would include zero emission sources of energy like nuclear power. The standard in place today is inflexible, Scott told lawmakers. He urged them to adopt his administration's proposal to get to utilities to 100% clean energy by 2030 at a substantially lower cost. It's time we join other northeastern states who have already recognized that proven renewable and clean sources like solar, hydro, and yes, even nuclear must be part of the solution. Here's what he's predicting. Changes could lower Vermont's renewable energy requirement from 100% for most utilities by 2030 to 75%, according to the bill. Representative Kathleen James from Manchester, chair of the House Energy and Digital Infrastructure Committee, heard testimony on this bill last spring. The Clean Energy Standard and estimates provided by the DPS indicated that rolling back the requirements and allowing utilities to get credit for buying nuclear power would save about $4 million a year out of the roughly $1 billion that Vermonters spend on electricity every year. Coupled with that, whatever your feelings are about nuclear power, this coming Tuesday, February 10th, 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Oaks Room, that is the Vermont Law School, Vermont Law and Graduate School, Oaks Room 210, a panel will offer perspectives opposing nuclear power as part of the Hoodwinked in the Hot House series. So that'll be on Tuesday. Just to give you a quick background, the program is hosted by BAIL, 350 Vermont, the White River Node, the Environmental Justice Law Society, and the Energy Law Society, both of them here at the Vermont Law and Graduate School. So just a little bit there on nuclear. It doesn't seem like it's going to go away, Henry.
Well, the AI companies don't care what power costs, and because they make so much money on AI, or they project that they're going to if they aren't making it now. And so they are swinging to generating their own power. And at the moment, they're buying up things like jet engine turbines and mounting them on trucks to generate electricity at their plants and burning fossil fuels in them to do it.
Wow.
So they're the thing that's pushing the demand curve way faster than the grid knows how to catch up with. And there's a project which we'll put a link in our show notes on the first fusion power plant that would not have radioactive waste left behind is breaking ground in the state of Washington. for being largely paid for by the AI people. I raised my eyebrows and would be interested to dig into why the costs for nuclear power are thought to be low.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. Maybe
I don't think they are.
Yeah, and maybe our guest, Peter Sterling, will have some thoughts about that. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Henry, I'm going to turn you down in the mix, and you go ahead and round up Peter. Dan Fogelberg from one of his early albums, Souvenirs, as the Raven Flies. Well, we're going to try to rejoin with Henry Swayze and Peter Sterling. Are you there, Henry?
We are, and welcome to Green Team, Peter Sterling.
Thanks so much for having me on again.
Yeah, always good to hear from you, Peter.
And maybe just start off with reminding people the grand scheme, you know, what's your role, Peter Sterling, and what is Renewable Energy Vermont?
Sure. So Renewable Energy Vermont is a 25-year-old nonprofit trade association that represents all the businesses and people working to get Vermont to 100% renewable, carbon-free energy future. And so we represent the people that hang up solar panels and try to bring more renewables online, try to bring more storage online, try to help with beneficial electrification like heat pumps and things like that. And, you know, the big thing that drives us is getting Vermont to reduce its carbon footprint in the thermal sector, you know, the home heating sector, and in the electric sector. And we've done a pretty good job of at least the electric sector, although we can do a lot better. So I'd love to talk more about that if we could.
Yeah, and then maybe we'll pivot to the cost of electricity, and the New England overall cost. I'm seeing in a report from the government that in 2025, there we are. Best place to go. November of 25. The overall New England cost is 28.86 cents a kilowatt, almost 29 cents.
Well, that's not exactly right. That's not what ratepayers are paying in Vermont or anywhere close to it. So I'm happy
Vermont,
to dive right into that.
Vermont is.
I smelled something different there. Yeah.
Yeah. First of all, Let's just to reset, just to give some framework for everyone who's listening. I have on our REBS website, we've done a lot of research on this. The electric rates in Vermont over the last decade have basically tracked with inflation. Okay, so yes, prices have gone up, but they're really not going up more than inflation. So So do we all want everything to go down? Of course. Do we want our taxes to go down? Of course. That isn't quite realistic as folks would want it to be. And let me just say, and this is important, I just want to get this out up front. When you look at what the utilities are saying, the reason they need to raise rates in Vermont are, and all these rate increases have to be approved by the Public Utility Commission. I mean, this is a quasi-judicial process, so you can't use hyperbole. You have to use actual numbers. The biggest drivers of rate increases that we have had in Vermont are, in no particular order, transmission costs, like connecting to the grid in both New England and in Vermont, labor and healthcare costs and taxes, and importantly, repairs due to storm recovery, which we all know are the more intense storms recently of climate change. Green Mountain Power said in its last rate filing, just storm recovery costs alone, like burying wires, putting new poles up, that's been 13% of their costs. That is exponentially higher than it was ever, 10 years ago. So when Vermont's rates are going up, basically tracking with inflation, they're going up not because we've invested in renewable energy, not because our utilities are scamming us out of money like in other states. It's because of costs, and one of the largest one is due to climate change.
Hmm. Hey, could I just ask a follow-on question there? Are those costs similar in the other New England states, the extra work of burying cables and new poles, et cetera?
No, Vermont, no. The other costs that are similar are the labor, healthcare taxes,
okay,
and transmission costs. That's affecting all of New England a lot. No, but Vermont has really suffered more storm damage than other New England states. And, when you think about the nature of the flooding we've had and some of the heavy snow storms we had, a couple Decembers ago, we had like three straight really heavy, wet snowstorms that brought down a lot of lines, like wet territory, suffered, millions of dollars of damage in poles and wires where normally they budget like $300,000 a year. So, the storm damage is hitting Vermont much, much harder because of our hilly terrain and the fact that we get more snow than the southern New England states.
Right. Understood. Henry?
So I don't need to dwell on this chart that I'm working on that you feel is not legit, but are New England prices noticeably higher than the rest of the country?
And what
are the drivers for that?
Okay, great question. And I'm not saying that that chart is not legitimate. I'm just saying there's a lot of context to that, and we need to understand that, there's a lot of ways to look at a chart like that. So yes, New England has amongst the highest rates in the nation. California would be up there as well. But one of the reasons New England has the highest rates, and this is all from what utility executives or ISO New England would say, this isn't from, Peter Sterling, the lefty activist types. It's because we rely so heavily on natural gas. And natural gas is very dependent on, how you can get it here, the cost of shipping it here. And we don't have a lot of pipelines coming into New England to get us that natural gas. The ports where it does arrive by sea are in Massachusetts. Those are constrained by size. And as we know, natural gas really is very sensitive to market fluctuations. So when it's really, really cold, that price flies right up. When there's a war in the Ukraine, let's say, and globally there's a big need for natural gas, the price in New England, we immediately feel that. Now, Vermont, here's the good news. Because Vermont resisted the urge to deregulate its utilities and let them play in the open market back in the late 90s, we are less price sensitive to natural gas shocks. We signed a lot more long-term contracts for wind and solar and hydro than other states. So if not, the price of natural gas bottoms out, gets really cheap, yeah, our rates don't go down like New Hampshire's do. But, when there's a problem, our rates don't go flying up. And overall, that has, I think, benefited Vermont ratepayers, not making Vermont less dependent on natural gas. And let's also remember, because while rates are important, there's also the climate change impact of Vermont not relying on natural gas as much as other states. Like, we're putting less our electric sector is responsible for less carbon going in the atmosphere. And that's actually an important point. that should not really be omitted.
So our costs for natural gas, because we draw most heavily on natural gas during times of shortage, of not mm-hmm. enough electricity to go around. So the peaker plants keep
right.
kicking, and
right.
and when they're kicking in,
yeah.
the demand is high for natural gas,
yeah.
and that
yeah.
drives the price of the natural gas
exactly
higher.
Exactly.
As well.
And one of the real contributing factors to that in 2025 and 2026, particularly, and this is a report came out, ICE New England even verified this. If those wind turbines off the shore of Massachusetts and Rhode Island had been online, like without the delays, that would have saved New England ratepayers $400 million for a,
wow.
over a 2-week cold snap last February. $400 million
wow.
New England ratepayers unnecessarily spent on natural gas because those wind turbines were not online. Just the availability of the power from the wind would have had such a serious price suppression impact on natural gas, meaning natural gas would have been less needed. It would have saved us, that's just a 2-week period, $400 million. And
wow.
so when you hear some stuff from, you know, the president about how, you know, we don't need wind and prices go up because of renewables, it's not true. Even ISO New England is saying the benefits of offshore wind to New England ratepayers would be measured in the probably in the billions of dollars by now.
Hmm.
Wow. So
yeah,
so
it is a wow.
So explain why
yeah.
why wind has a role
sure.
in this compared to just putting up more solar panels.
Sure, sure. Well, that's a great question, by the way. So first of all, the law in New England, throughout New England, is that if it's really, really cold and there isn't enough natural gas for people to get their heat, the law says you have to provide people heat before electricity with natural gas. So the second it gets really cold out, which is in the winter, all this natural gas is shunted to facilities that provide heat. And therefore, like you said, when we need electricity, which we do, the oil peaker plants come on, right? And they can come on in the middle of the night. And that's very beneficial, right? So people will still have electricity. A solar panel is obviously not, in this latitude, is obviously not as effective in the middle of a cold day. And obviously it's not effective at night. Offshore wind is very effective in the winter. The wind really blows strong in the winter off the coast of New England, and obviously it blows well in nighttime too. So those offshore wind turbines can produce power at a time when solar and even onshore wind is less effective. And so
wow.
by coming on at night, and you're able to displace those really expensive oil peaker plants that are providing power at night or when the snow is covering solar panels and such. So that it's just the perfect complement to all the stuff that we can generate during the day and the other and generate in the winter as well. And the other big resource we have in New England is hydropower, whether it's Quebec or hydro in New England. And that's not something you can crank up easily. It doesn't work like that in the winter. Offshore wind is the thing you can deploy quickly.
And could we stay on the offshore wind for just a moment?
Sure.
So we're seeing court rulings that, at least by my estimate, are all going against the administration that has been slowing or just stopping the final development of several offshore wind projects. Are you relatively confident that all those projects that the courts have said can continue will be up and online at some time in the next couple of years?
That's a really great question. I think the court rulings have really indicated that the Trump administration has not been able to provide a legitimate reason to stop their construction. By just claiming national security and saying that's all we've got, that has not been innate. The courts have ruled that's not enough to stop construction of these projects. That being said, would the Trump administration try some other tactic to delay these projects? That would not seem unlikely. That being said, it does seem like these projects are going to move forward. Will Trump be able to delay them more with some other egregious tactics? I can't tell you that. But I will say this to everyone out there. at some point, these wind turbines will get built. There is simply no other power source that is accessible to New England. I don't believe we are going to be able to deploy nuclear power in this region anytime soon. I mean, we could just throw it out for Vermonters. I mean, are Vermonters willing to site another nuclear power plant here? I mean, no. No one wants one of these things around. So without offshore wind, and given that our relationship with Canada is so much more fraught because of, you know, the president calling it the 51st state, I don't think Hydro-Québec is going to be sending us any excess power that they have. I don't know. It's even questionable whether they have excess power. So if Hydro-Québec doesn't have a lot of excess power for us and we're not putting a new nuclear plant in, no one can build a gas plant anytime soon. So I think these offshore wind turbines are really the only solution for New England's growing power needs, unless everyone starts turning off the lights and conserving at a level that we've never even imagined.
Uh-huh.
So I think they'll all be built by 2035, and that's good news.
Other ways of dropping the cost of electricity. My understanding is that the grid, that having to build new grid infrastructure, repair, you mentioned, and that's been very expensive, and we probably can't fix that because storms are going to be more extreme as time goes on. But building new infrastructure, we're only utilizing our grid at about 50% capacity,
right,
is my understanding.
Right.
But that during extreme situations, we have to be able to supply electricity. So they want a buffer in there. So talk some about ways of lowering the cost by making better use of the grid we have.
Right. So for listeners, because I think that's a really great point, our electric grid is much like the highway system, right? There are two lanes on 89 and 91. We don't need two lanes all the time, but when you need it, you need it. So you overbuild a road just because you build for peak capacity. You know, you obviously would not want to have six lanes because that's madness, but you generally try to build for what you think you need, and that's what we're doing with the grid. You know, there are a lot of the costs are from, you know, bringing in power from other places to Vermont. Moving power is very, very costly. So I believe the more power we can generate in Vermont, it really does reduce rates. So the more people can go solar at home, the more we can have like just smaller in-state, you know, renewables. That ultimately helps bring down the cost of power to Vermonters. And the other thing we could do, and this is more of a big picture vision thing, but has the potential to, you know, provide untold savings, is if all this offshore wind we're able to come online, and in addition to all the solar New England produces, a lot of times that power, you know, is not wasted, but it's not utilized the best way it could. So what a lot of people are talking about and is having a two-way power line to Canada. So when we're generating all our solar power or cheap wind power, send it to Canada so they can use it, let them keep their cheap hydropower, that water behind the dams. And then when we need more power, when our renewable resources aren't producing, like in the winter or at night, have Canada send us, you know, more power back down. You know, two-way power with, you know, direction with Quebec would really unlock a lot. Basically using Canada's dams as a reservoir, a battery for us. And let me just give you one quick statistic. I think it's an incredible statistic. If it did not rain in Quebec for a year, there's enough energy stored behind Hydro-Québec's dams that would power the state of New York for a year and a half. That is an incredible number. There is so much water stored behind those dams in northern Canada. Now, I think most of us agree we don't want to see more flooding in Canada for our energy needs, but what's there is there. And we could, if we were able to use that hydropower as essentially a battery, instead of buying the high-priced power from natural gas plants when it's really cold or really hot, that would save ratepayers billions of dollars. Was that clear? Do y'all understand what I'm talking about?
I do, and
it
I'm
really
just,
is an
incredible
option.
I'm wondering, of course, down the road about the diplomacy, which there is a lack of between the United States and Canada right now, but I'd like to see it happen.
Yeah. Well, Canada would want this. Hydro-Quebec wants this to happen because they know that this hydro resource of theirs is incredibly valuable, and they would rather sell it at a time when we need it most and use our cheap wind and solar power when it's beneficial for Quebec. Like this would benefit both parties. It's just a matter of making it happen over time.
Yeah. So does that mean I'm getting further into the geekiness? Maybe I shouldn't do that. Maybe I should just repeat what you said and make sure the listeners understand it. So the wind power, say at nighttime when wind blows and solar panels don't work, we would use that. But the average household in Vermont certainly doesn't burn nearly as much electricity in the middle of the night as it does during the time we get up in the morning and cook breakfast and the time we get home from work at the end of the day and start washing dishes and doing all the household chores that might use electricity. And so that nighttime time is always probably going to be, heat pumps would be operating at nighttime. And as we move more and more to heat pumps, they'll have a bigger load on the electric system, but nighttime probably won't ever soak up all the wind. And so, if we could use what we need of it and then ship the rest of it to Canada through an electrical system,
a two-way
grid, then that electricity that would have gone to waste, Hydro-Quebec can buy perhaps at a low cost and sell it back to us at a little higher cost when we need it most during our peak times, and have that reservoir act like a great big storage reservoir.
Yeah, that's right.
A great big battery for us.
Basically, use our wind and solar when it's cheapest, and then in return, instead of using their hydro up, save it and sell it back to us at a reasonable rate when we need it most. So Quebec dams would be a battery for us, a storage battery for us.
So that requires a high-cost transmission line.
Yeah.
I know the cost of the transmission from Hydro-Quebec to New York City comes out at 10 or 15 cents a kilowatt. It's not cheap to move electricity.
Their Hydro-Quebec is selling its power through that line to New York City for just over 10 cents a kilowatt hour.
That isn't a
terrible price. I mean,
no, that's fine. So I attended one of the REV conferences where I was hearing Hydro-Quebec talking about it. And someone from the audience asked, what's the transmission cost, the actual cost of the high voltage line going to cost? And that was, I think they said, an extra 10 cents a kilowatt for just moving the power because of amortizing the cost of the line. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, the number I've heard is that the power contract is for 10 cents a kilowatt hour, which
maybe I was misunderstanding the answer to that question.
Because adding 10 cents would make it, if Hydro-Quebec has to sell that for something. But, let me just say, whatever the number per kilowatt hour is, whatever that number is,
it's way cheaper than peaker.
That's right. The regulators of New York it's the law. They would have to prove that line benefited ratepayers. So that price, no matter how expensive it may seem, was cheaper than a natural gas plant or even a nuclear plant. So it still is a win for ratepayers, and that's the bottom line.
Okay, excellent. So let me go to another question, which I don't know if you have an opinion about, but so that's using Hydro-Québec as a storage battery. That's making it so we use less. We never get those high costs. Those peaker plant electricity can run over $1 a kilowatt, even $2 a kilowatt under the worst kind of conditions. And we don't see that in our bill. It's just amortized over the cost of the utility for a whole year. But there's enormous savings.
Well, we do see in our bill, just to be clear, like there's not like a separate line, but we pay a higher rate because we rely on those peaker plants. Let's all be super clear.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So there's two things. One is that those oil peaker plants, which are the dirtiest and most expensive, there's one right here in downtown Burlington on the waterfront that I visited once at a rally, and those plants are inefficient and basically it's electricity at whatever cost you have to pay for it. How do we and the utilities, if they never use those plants, they still charge a great deal to keep them ready and be available.
Yes, sir. That's how exactly right. Yes, sir.
How do we swing away from that and make it so those peaker plants don't exist? How do we replace that? We have offshore wind you just spoke about, and that's a major way. What about the idea of people being able to give a little bit of their battery storage back to the grid?
That's right.
Or that kind of move.
Yep, that's exactly right. And that there's been numerous studies done by Union of Concerned Scientists and others that show that for New England, investing in battery storage would save ratepayers money by lessening or even and eventually eliminating the demand for those peaker plants. Basically, if we build enough batteries and people can store enough power from the sun and the wind when it's being generated, we would not need those peaker plants, which is largely at night and during these cold snaps. So it's investing in energy storage, both at the residential scale, people putting these things in their basement or their garage, or building the larger, you know, commercial, you know, utility scale energy storage. That's the way to do it. I mean, the other thing that also always helps, and we don't talk about it enough because, well, maybe we just should, is people just should be conserving energy. When it's really, really cold out, think about how warm your house has to be. Are you leaving your car running all the time if it's an EV? You know, just conserving energy during peaks of coldest weather and warmest weather. Do you really need that air conditioner on all the time? That's a big deal. Using less power is the best thing we could ever do all the time.
Well, as the old phrase goes, the kilowatt not used is the least expensive and the least damaging. This came up at an emergency preparedness meeting that happened locally here with a couple towns involved, both Royalton and Tunbridge. And there was a representative from Green Mountain Power who was very well spoken. And she echoes what you're saying, Peter, with that battery backup. Yeah. And then there was an installer from a local solar company called Catamount Solar. And he emphasized the point that, you know, being efficient, conserving power, not just when it's really cold and when the demand is really high, but getting into the habit of conserving energy at all times of the year. Yeah. And I'm hoping that's going to resonate with consumers and users of electricity and our neighbors around here.
Yeah, because I'll say, I just want to throw in there, one of the downsides I found, at least from my friends who have heat pumps, I don't. We have a wood stove. Is that these are, even though they're great in the winter and all, they're basically free air conditioners in the summer. And I have a lot of friends that never used the air conditioner in their whole lives, but now there's a heat pump, they leave that thing on to cool their house in the summer. And that's driving a lot of summer demand. And that's when those peakers come on, when it's really hot. And people need to understand that cooling their house in the middle of a heat wave has a real consequence for climate.
Yeah. Let me just go back and, you know, we focused on this program, and for me personally, focused on trying to use less power, figure out how to be more efficient, make live better with less. And it's a chore. And I think it shifts the responsibility for everything. It sort of blames the problems we're having on the individual. And I don't think the individual is going to be able to fix this problem. I think the system has to fix it more than the individuals do. And so going back to this storage component, I'm an avid listener to David Roberts's Volts, and he's always going on about virtual power supplies. A virtual power supply is saying, okay, it's time to kick on the peaker plant that is making very expensive, dirty electricity. Well, if you could simply have, say, the hot water heater in your home not come on for that two-hour period and simply rely on the water that was in the tank already, that's what's called virtual power. And it requires your appliances to talk to the grid and back and forth. It requires communication. But that's not being the many people that he has had on have felt that that was just an enormous kind of storage battery or peaker plant. And that we really could reduce the amount of grid reconstruction had to be done.
Right.
And do you have any thoughts about whether there's ways of moving forward with that in Vermont?
Totally. So that would be the other than energy storage, like you said. I also think, virtual power plants is kind of like the nerdiest kind of name that doesn't really help us. But the technology that would make our appliances not use power during peaks or give back power during peaks is the other biggest way to not have to build out lines, right? So one great example that is coming online and that is happening are all these EVs that people have are, massive batteries.
Yes.
There are massive batteries in these cars, way bigger than those Tesla Powerwalls that you put in your house. And so it's called vehicle-to-grid technology, and it's coming on in more cars and in more chargers that you basically charge up your EV during the day when your solar panels are cranking at your house. And let's say you're not driving. You now have 40 kilowatts of power sitting in that car. Let your car push that electricity back into your house, power your house, and then in the day when the sun is shining, you can repower your car. Now, you'd obviously have to do some thinking about if you're not driving and all that, but really for most people, that's a very workable thing to do, right? If your car's, you're not going to use your car, get paid to send power back to the grid, from that, when that power was charging, the avoided cost during the day of solar power is 6 or 7 cents a kilowatt. When you need it at night and it's closer to 18 or 20 cents a kilowatt because it's really cold or something, that, that's a pretty big delta, right, guys? That kind of virtual power plant would save people a lot of money. And also, when you're doing that en masse for thousands of EVs, that's many megawatts of power you don't have to build a grid for. And as you alluded to earlier, the cost of these lines is, building out transmission lines is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So if you can start avoiding, several hundred megawatts of new grid construction because all of a sudden people's car batteries are powering their houses when we need it most, that is huge savings. It stops you, like you said earlier, from having to overbuild the grid for these peak moments. That is a giant way to bring our rates down. And also, let's be honest, not have any impact, be good for the climate too, which is important.
Hey, I've got one last question before we need to let you go, Peter, and that is, do you have high hopes for this balcony solar bill of making it through the legislature and onto Governor Scott's desk? And how important do you think it is?
I'm can never predict what this governor will do. He's been pretty consistent in trying to throttle back any real progress on climate change. That being said, the Department of Public Service is not opposing this bill, and that usually is a good harbinger for the governor signing it. That being said, we never know what happens. I think that if listeners could remember one thing from this all this talk that we're doing, which, by the way, this is a great conversation. Once again, great questions. The one thing I'd like every listener to remember is, because we use natural gas and oil when we need more electricity, every time a Vermonter goes solar, it at some point stops one of those peaker plants from coming online. And that is really, really important. Really important. So every time we go solar or use a renewable in Vermont, it stops natural gas or oil from being burned at some point elsewhere in New England. And so this, this balcony solar, this plug-in solar, if it helps more Vermonters go solar where they live and where they work, that will displace fossil fuels. Just by that metric alone, that is incredibly, incredibly important.
Okay, great.
And so, and anything that normalizes solar helps people understand that solar power can work. It also moves the ball forward for the bigger reforms that we need, like, helping net metering, and things like that. So I think there's only positives for this portable solar. There's no downsides, and I do hope it becomes law. And I'm grateful for Senator Ann Watson and Representative Kath James for their leadership to make sure this is moving.
Excellent. Well, we'll let you go. I gather you have other meetings and appointments to be at, and it's been great visiting with you.
Real quick.
Okay. Hey, keep up the good work, Peter.
Hey, I really appreciate the questions. Looking forward to the next time we chat already. Have a great day, guys.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
All right. Yeah, spending a lot of time there on electricity. And interesting, that two-way line that could run from Quebec down to Vermont and back, depending on who's got more power in storage and depending on the time of the year. I like that concept, international diplomacy. Hey, real quick on international trade and back to power, and this would be in the fossil fuel world. There was quite a bit of talk about using natural gas here in stressful power moments in the state of Vermont and other places. The trade deal that our president is touting, I don't know if it's probably not been finalized, with India to ship natural gas, I imagine it's the LNG form, to India in a trade for them not buying so much oil from Russia. Henry, I don't know about that deal. What do you think? Well, maybe we'll just move on.
Someone's pocket.
Yeah, right.
Trump. I think there is. So liquefied natural gas requires liquefying it. And you do that because you can carry a whole lot more liquefied natural gas then you could compress natural gas
right
on a
huge tanker,
or given tank size,
yeah,
a tanker. But it is an expensive process, and it takes lots of energy to do that. So it's not a free deal. It all comes down to costing. It's true that India has been. China is the biggest emitter. India and the United States are—I don't know which one—but we're similar amount. And India has not made moves away from coal and fossil fuels the way China has. I mean, not that they are—they're still emitting like crazy because they have lots of coal-fired power plants still operating. But their new electricity demand is being met by solar and wind, and that's not yet happened in India. And so, if Trump and his buddies want to sell more natural gas and they sell it to India, India will burn it. And if they can use that as a political lever to drop the cost of the value of Russia's oil, so they don't have so many dollars to run their military campaign. I'd say that's a positive sideline, but if it actually increases the amount of natural gas and gas fracking that's going on in order to supply that market, then I don't know how you flip that coin.
Yeah, pretty tricky situation. Hey, Henry, do we have time or do we want to wait till next week to talk about this fusion power plant slated to open in Washington State in a couple of years?
Well, I think I've said almost as much as I know about it.
Okay.
I haven't really dug into this. I know that it is. I've been interested in fusion for a long time and have been following somewhat. And I've been particularly interested in small-scale fusion plants rather than really large-scale ones. And the international, Europe and the United States have an international program to try to develop commercial fusion that's been going on for, I don't know what, 25 or 35 years, a long time. And they have stuck with the lowest temperature fusion. That's required superconducting magnets, and they have sophisticated those and made them work really well, and that creates a magnetic bottle that contains the fusion. And this plant that's being built somehow does an end run on that system. I know it runs on deuterium, and I think that that the Tullamore runs on deuterium too, but I'm not an expert on that. I've not researched that lately. I've really been interested in very high temperature fusion that did not require a magnetic bottle. That's what I have looked at most.
All right.
Six different companies around the world worked on that. Anyway, so the advantage of fusion is you have no radioactive material left over, and you have very little radioactive material or radiation happening while you're doing it. It has that as a major advantage, and making it cost effective is the part that has eluded us. Wind and solar are, theoretically, all the AI money that is going towards it will drive that technology forward and make it more cost effective. How fast that happens and how it rings out, we'll have to see.
Okay, well, we are traveling.
Smart people chose this as a plan, put money into it, said, let's build it.
So we're down to less than 2 minutes. We are listening to a little bit of Electric Avenue underneath us from Eddie Grant. And interesting that our guest, Peter Sterling, brought up the backup battery power possibilities involved in our transportation sector. I'm going to Bill McKibben's Substack here. And back to Canada, their decision to encourage EVs, even Chinese ones, has, of course, drawn Trump's fury. But there were more signs last week that our president's attempt to stall the EV revolution is only working here in the U.S. Sales are up sharply, not only in Europe, but also Turkey, Brazil, Mexico. For decades, climate progress has largely come from cleaning up the power sector. Burn gas instead of coal. Replace power plants with wind turbines or solar panels, and you can slash the amount of planet heating gas spewed into the atmosphere for very little cost. Now, early signs suggest transportation may be on the brink of delivering similar wins. EVs have quickly gained grounds in markets outside Europe and North America, avoiding a rise in global fuel-burning vehicles and leapfrogging the development path that Richard countries have taken in transport. So definitely, if you want to keep up with a lot of environmental news, you might want to check out Bill McKibben's Substack. We do want to thank the folks who make Green Zine possible each week, the Yes We Can Collective, Wit and Grit, Solaflect, Bale, Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, and the Upper Pass Beer Company. Henry, looking forward to chatting with you next week.
Yes, indeed. We'll see if we can get off the electric kid kicking.